Hello everyone, my name is Philippe, and this is the podcast Life with AI, the podcast that we talk about artificial intelligence in a simpler way. And here today, I'm with Eric, and we're going to talk about Consensus, that is his company, and maybe a bit of his background. I think it's going to be a really interesting episode, a bit technical and maybe a bit entrepreneurship. So thanks a lot for coming. And Eric, can you present yourself, please?
Yeah, thank you for having me. So my name is Eric Olson. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Consensus. Just a little bit of background on myself. My background, both professionally and academically, is in traditional data science. I got my master's in university in data science, and then I worked at the sports betting company DraftKings for a little over 3 years in the data science department, doing all things building models to analyze customer behavior and data. And then it was last summer, in the summer of 2021, that I came over full-time to Consensus.
Yeah, if you can explain Consensus, please.
Certainly. So what Consensus is a search engine that uses artificial intelligence to find answers to your questions within research papers. So basically, the functionality allows you to come and type in a natural language question. It could be something about like a health topic. Let's say you say, can fish oil help with inflammation? If you type that into Google, instead of getting a bunch of links to clickbaity blogs written on the subject by who knows what, you actually will get claims that have been made within research papers about that statement. So there'll be studies that have looked to actually answer that question, and we will pull out the claims that the scientists have made about it. So the idea is to try to take the ease of use of a search engine like Google and pair it with the rigorous underlying source material of Google Scholar.
Yeah. And can you say, like, how did you came up with the idea of Consensus?
Yeah. So honestly, it came from a problem in my own life where, you know, I'm not a scientist by trade, but I appreciate the scientific process and try to make my arguments and conclusions and beliefs be rooted in evidence. But I do not have the skill nor attention span to actually go through the research on a subject. So I wanted this for myself. I wanted to be able, when I had a question, be able to type in my question and learn what the research actually says about it. Because too many times I'm in an argument or I'm trying to think about how I feel about something and I realize I have no idea what I'm talking about. And usually the person I'm talking to has no idea what they're talking about. And there are people who have dedicated their lives to empirically studying these questions, but the access to that data has been really, really hard and sometimes impossible up until this point. So I wanted to build a tool that created that access point for people like myself who wanted better evidence-based answers, but did not have the research-laden background to actually come across them.
Yeah, what I did like myself about the platform that I tested some time ago is that, like, you not only have the link containing the article, because like it's not that easy to read the article as a non-technical person, but you have the answer in a small quote, yeah, like Google is doing right now. Well, can you explain how this works? Maybe explain before how does a search engine work, and then we can go deep into the details of it.
Yeah, so you know, search engines work in a variety of different ways. I can talk. Why don't I talk about like what a traditional like academic search engine, so if a Google Scholar or a PubMed, let's call it, those are really simple. All they're really doing is they're looking at the keywords of your query and then trying to exact match them, maybe some like semantic similarity, I don't know, to the likely just the title of the paper. I'm not exactly sure how they do it, but potentially some of the text, maybe of the abstract. So basically like the simplest way a search engine can be built is just like exact matching of whatever the index is built over with the query. You can then take it a slightly deeper level where you have some like what would be called like vector similarity search, which is basically like the more advanced version of keywording where you have the query, then you have the index, and it's trying to do some like semantic matching of it. Or basically the simplest way to describe it is like it's the step beyond keyword. It does like synonyms. So like if I said, does fish oil help with inflammation? That vector similarity search would probably return me a paper that said the research on omega-3s and inflammation. It would understand that those two are very related concepts and they're actually saying the same thing. That can be done with a variety of different levels of complexity that is closer to keyword and further away from keyword. And then there's like the furthest end of the spectrum, which is like, a true Q&A system, which is like what we're trying to build, where it is taking in a question. It can also just take in a regular query, and it's trying to parse some meaning of what they're asking and then deliver a different type of set of results depending on what they're asking. This is how like a Google works, except for obviously not just over academic material. That's over the entire internet, where if you type in a question into Google or you type in just a bunch of keywords, the search engine can actually be a bit flexible and it will try to return you what it estimates is most likely that you want. And there's a million different ways to do it. You know, you can have like the featured snippet part where it's really like looking through the text of something and trying to pick out the part that answers your question. That's kind of effectively what we're doing. You could have it where it's just sending you back a bunch of links, which Google does underneath, which we've kind of done a hybrid of both, where we're trying to give you the snippet that answers your question. But if you click that snippet, it is just a link back to the article. So you can see where it comes from and you can see who's actually seeing it. So I hope that wasn't too convoluted, but basically there's, you know, a whole spectrum of ways you can do it. You can do simple keyword matching over whatever your index. You can do slightly more advanced like vector similarity. And then you can do super advanced like AI search that allows it to be really flexible where you can have some like Q&A components to it. And we fit on that far end of the spectrum.
Yeah. And I imagine that you have a big problematic into like how good is the result and how long does it take to match the query into the links, right? So I imagine that you don't use it only one technique, because I imagine that like query, like doing a question,
it's a funnel,
a Q&A. Yeah. So maybe you try to filter some of
the articles. Exactly. You're exactly using, right.
Can you go deep into this one?
Like, yeah.
Process? I'm really interested on the subject. I've never studied search engines before, and like it's interesting for me.
Well, you sound like you have, because that's a really, this is a really common technique to be able to insert more like heavy compute, intense machine learning into your search engine. Because you're exactly right. If you try to just do like this beautiful large language model Q&A over a corpus of millions of potential results, like that's just going to take forever. And that is not practical to actually be running a search. So yeah. What you do is you use some of that further end of the spectrum, the easier end, lower compute end of the spectrum, to narrow the search space. And that's exactly what we do. And this is a pretty common technique where basically, so like pretend you've asked a question to our search engine. I'll keep using the same one. Does fish oil help with inflammation? What we do is we take out the stop words. So we take out the words that aren't like nouns in the subject and the important parts of the query. We take out does and with. So it's just fish oil, inflammation, and help. And then basically what you do is you just do a keyword search over the text of the abstract and the title to narrow the space to about 5,000 possible results. And then we move down that spectrum. And then we do a vector similarity search of over those 5,000. Now just do the same thing, except we're doing it slightly more advanced, where we can, you know, parse out some additional complex like relationships, and we narrow that space to, I believe it's about 250, and then we run our true like Q&A engine. So it's like out of the top 250 results that we have narrowed the space down to, now run this like advanced machine learning Q&A matching system. And you know, there's different ways you can like slice it, but this is a really common way to insert some additional hardcore analysis into your search engine where it isn't costing you tons of money and taking tons of time.
And what about the interpretability of your system? Do you use like fully large language model to do the rank of the top 10 so on? Or do you have some thoughts of why it's searching, it's finding this one in the end or not?
Yeah, great question. So the short answer is it's fully just a large language relevancy ranking. But there's a little more complexity if you really get down to the details. And I'll try to share a little bit without getting too deep. So when we do that vector similarity step, we actually have some weights also on the recency and the citation count that basically try to say if it is relatively equal in terms of similarity. So you think about a result and each result gets a score of how like, you know, how well does it score in this vector similarity. Then it basically is saying if it's the same, give it a little weight towards if it's more highly cited and if it's a more recent article. And then that narrows that space down to that last step where it's purely just relevancy ranking done by a large language model. Now, the way that we've trained that large language model is we fine tune it on a set of annotations where we gave scientists question and possible answer pairs and we have them rank them. and then we feed that data to a Q&A ranker large language model, and we have it learn how to rank these answers. So it's like a very specifically fine-tuned on this custom set of annotations language model that does the final ranking. But to get us to that space to do that final ranking off of, we do have some additional like finger on the scale weights for citation count and date, if that makes sense.
Yeah. In this fine-tuning process, do you use just supervised learning, or are you used also reinforcement learning as ChatGPT? Have you tried?
So we don't have like a reinforcement learning loop set up, but we do it kind of like manually. What we do is every like month we export all the questions that have been asked, and then we pull out the top 20 answers currently in our system. Then we go get those annotated, and then we feed that back and retrain it. Yeah. So we're basically it's like a manual reinforcement loop in some ways, but we. It's something we'd love to do in the future, but we just don't have that infrastructure like set up yet to have it truly be like, each person who's gained a set of results can click it and continue to train the system. It's not that advanced yet.
Yeah, but I don't know if you agree with me, but I see a really good case of reinforcement learning here, because if you can train a reward exactly what the humans did to classify which link is better than the other, you can just train a reward model to do it for you, and you can train your model forever without any.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. And like I said, we kind of do that, just not as like sleek. Much more manual and not like continuous set of parameters.
Yeah, but this is interesting for the future, because you are in the beta phase, right? And one of my questions is, what do you think you still need to go to actually launching?
Yeah, you know, we have launched. We have over 25,000 users. Mm. So, you know, the beta tags are kind of arbitrary. It's meant to signal that this is a new technology. We've only been launched for about 3 months. We're going to continue to make it better. And I don't think this is some finished product. We are extremely close to launching our first like premium additional feature. We hope to do that by the end of the month. When we do that, I think we're internally discussing taking the beta tag off. But really, the beta tag is meant to serve as a place to just say, hey, like this is a new technology, not everything is going to be perfect. And if you hover over the tag, we give a little disclaimer. And we think that that's important to have that somewhere in the product. And having a beta tag kind of makes it that like natural place to have a disclaimer. So, you know, ChatGPT, I think, is like in beta technically, right? But like a million people have used it. So like yes. We're all, you know, this technology is new. All these products are going to have some issues with them. So I think it's... a lot of people are throwing beta tags on their products to indicate that. And it isn't meant to say that we're like in, you know, we're private and we're only restricting usage. Like we're not, anybody can sign up. It's meant to just say, hey, this is new, use discretion when using the product, and it's going to keep getting better.
Yeah. And you said you're going to launch in the end of the month of maybe next month, the premium version. Can you talk about it or?
No, certainly. It's a premium feature we're going to have on top of it. And we're going to have it free to start. Cause we think it's an opportunity for some publicity and getting more eyeballs on the product. But features like this are eventually what we'll put behind paywalls. And so the first version of it is when you've asked a yes, no question, we are going to give you a nice little view at the top of your results that classify all of the top results of which side of the fence they fit on. So again, does fish oil help with inflammation? You're going to see a nice chart at the top of your results where our language model's gone through the results and said 15 studies say yes, 3 studies say yeah, 2 studies say no, and it'll give you that view right in one snapshot. And then alongside that, we're going to give a little summary that we'll hopefully use ChatGPT to do for us, except for it will not be like what we want our real value prop to be is we don't want it to be like just what ChatGPT would say out of the ether. We want it to say, hey, here are the top 25 results, summarize those. So we can say, all right, here's this 2-sentence summary of the results, and here's the results that power it. You know where they're coming from, it's citing its sources. And we think that that's of huge importance for what we're trying to do, that it's not just generated out of thin air.
Nice. And well, I don't know if you thought about this feature, but I was thinking about it yesterday, maybe a way of improving, not improving the system, but using it in another way, is as a fact check. Because if you're reading all those scientific papers and you can summarize it, you can see if what someone posted on the internet is true or not. So maybe a tool for Facebook or Twitter where you can verify in the moment that the person makes the post if it's true or false.
Yeah, we've talked about this. So I think this is something we'd love to do. And there's some really cool opportunity to, like, yeah, the way that I've thought about it is, if you have, so pretend somebody in a post or a blog is making a claim, what you can do is you can use these language models to take that claim and make a question out of it. It's like, what is the research question around this claim? And then insert that into the engine.
Yeah.
And then if we have the little summary, we can then just link to the summary and be like, oh, well, they're, you know, sure this person, yeah, this is BS.
You can even give the answer, or even like say, no, no, it's not true. If the person is just saying, okay, vaccines are not good. So, oh, I'm sorry, I have 150,000 articles in the
office. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
I think you have a lot of opportunities. This is super nice. And what about the team that is working on it? How many engineers do you have? Because I think that is not that easy to build the system like this.
Yeah, so we're still a young company. We have five full-time employees, including myself. So we're pretty darn small. We are hiring right now, and we will have more. But the core engineering work has been done by three engineers.
Oh, good people.
they're rock stars. We're trying to stay lean. You know, the venture market is murky right now, and you don't want to bloat and grow too fast. So we're trying to stay lean, mean, and flexible.
Yeah. And what about the technologies that you use inside Consensus? Like, can you open it a little bit? Like, I imagine that you use Hugging Face to have access to these large language models.
Exactly.
Could you go a bit deep on it?
Yeah. So the there's two main language models that we have fine-tuned. One is the one that extracts the information from papers. The other is the one that we talked about before that is like the question and answer ranker. So they're two completely separate models that we've fine-tuned on annotations done by scientists. Both of them are actually the same underlying foundational. And the model that is Biomed Roberta. And that is an iteration of BERT, which is Google's original large language, or one of Google's original large language models. So it's different than GPT-3, same family, large language model. We actually find it does better for these like more classical classification type tasks. GPT is it's truly world-class for generative tasks, because those two tasks are not generative. It's like, it's going through sentences and classifying and then extracting. We actually found that it does better. And then the biomed portion means it's further pre-trained, and it's further pre-trained on academic literature. So it actually has some like embedded underlying knowledge of the source material that we're actually running it over. And it's a running joke on our team that like, whenever a new model comes out, we try to test it. Nothing can beat Biomed Roberta. So, you know, we keep like being like, oh, do we need to be having GPT-3 in there? But like, we can't get it to beat Biomed Roberta at this task. So like when we do summarization tasks, we're going to be using some OpenAI models. But for the core two main tasks, it is a Biomed Roberta foundational model that we use fine-tuned on our own data that we've created.
Yeah. So this is the part of training, fine-tuning your model. But what about deploying this model? Because your models are deployed. How do you do it, and how do you keep track of it, if it's working well or not?
As far as like in production, how do we keep track of it's working well or not? Okay, so this is the part that I know the least about. My background is data science, so like I'm very hands-on on when we're training these models and creating the annotation data and analyzing its performance on a test set. That's what I spend a lot of my time doing. I'm not as technical for like the true production and like how it's all hosted and how it all communicates to one another. We use Google Cloud. We use Hugging Face, but I would be lying if I said I could give you a good answer to your original question.
Yeah, but what about the metrics that you use to measure the performance? Do you have some thoughts about it?
As far as when, you know, as far as when we're training it and then testing it, or as far as how it's doing in production? So not in a super robust way. Like we don't, you know, we more track user behavior as like a proxy. So like how often are people clicking into results? How often are people sharing results, and not on a, you know, a truly individual level, on like an aggregate level. We're using that to track performance in the models, but we don't have a way to say for every query, how well did we answer this question?
Because like an easy way of doing so is to see how many people are clicking the first, second, third, fourth article.
Yeah, we do do that. But that is the level that we're looking at. We don't have like this super brilliant systematic way to say, hey, are we, you know, addressing the question in whatever way, but that is the type of thing that we do analysis on. Okay.
Okay. So last two questions before entering the entrepreneurship part that I also want to ask some questions. There are first one. How do you enter into the link and you choose the part that answers the question?
Sorry, can you ask one more time?
You have the quote in the beginning of the above all the links. How do you find this quote and choose, okay, this is the best answer for this question? How does the model work for this part?
Yeah, so it's, like I said before, it's a two-step process. So one is the extraction piece. So we actually do this ahead of time. And so what we do is we train a language model that is fine-tuned on data from scientists, where they go through papers and they annotate where scientists are making their claims based on the evidence of their experiment. So we have these like pretty robust definitions of what that means. And basically, it's trying to get around then talking about background information or supporting information. And we're just trying to find the sentences that are based on what they studied.
This is annotated.
Yep. And then we get a bunch of annotations on that. And then we train a model how to extract those sentences. So then basically we have this giant now database of scientific claims. And then that is what we do, that whole search funnel that I talked about before. And then again, the last step is another language model that has been fine-tuned to then rank claims based on questions. And then that's how we choose what to present to you. What sentence to show you, that is done ahead of time where we're extracting claims. And then what we choose the ordering, it is done by this language model ranker that we discussed previously. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Because for me, what wasn't making sense is that I was trying to figure out a way of doing it in a self-supervised way. But for me, it was impossible. You do need annotation to see, okay, this is the part that it answers.
Right. Or else you'll just be picking out random sentences where they could be saying something, which don't get me wrong, it still can happen. But we've done a pretty darn good job of eliminating these where an author could just say, previous research has said that fish oil does nothing for inflammation. And then the claim of the paper is actually fish oil solves all your problems. And like, but you could have extracted the top one. Then you said that, hey, Eric said that fish oil does nothing. But actually the real claim of the paper is that it did all these wonderful things.
Cool. Thanks. And the last question is, when you store your database, do you already store the vectors of the query, not the vector of the queries, but the vector of the title of claims. The papers? So you don't need to do a forward pass on all of this?
Yes, I believe so. Yeah, we have embedded, we have mapped out embeddings for title, claim, abstract.
And well, sorry, last question. Do you use a user feature embedding to enter into your model to rank the top links? Because like Google uses it to give you a link or another based on your history. Do you also use it or not yet? And do you plan to use it?
You know, one of like the value props of our system is that no matter who you are, no matter what you've done previously, no matter where you are, no matter whatever, you're going to get the same set of results. Our goal is to always just get you the best possible answers that answer your question. And we'd have to think extremely carefully and thoughtfully if we wanted to do any like user curating, which doesn't mean there couldn't be a room for it in the future, but like that is part of the value prop of what we're trying to do. You know, if I type something into Google and you type something into Google, we'll get different answers for a variety of different reasons. There could be some real problems with that, especially for the types of questions that people are coming to consensus for.
It makes total sense for me. Nice. Well, maybe let's go for the entrepreneur part because I have some questions too about it.
For sure.
So how is it be to be a CEO of a company and have people that you are managing and trying to grow as person, as engineer, and also growing the company?
So just like generally, like how's the experience?
Yeah, and maybe we can go deep.
Yeah. You know, I really enjoy it. I come from an athletic background and it's made me really enjoy working with teams and working toward unified goals. I think as a leader, I'm improving. I think I'm naturally okay at it. I think I do some things naturally very well and some things naturally not very well. And I think that's been one of the real big learnings in the past year of being a leader of the company is, seeing what without much work I've done well, and seeing if you don't continue to work at things, how poorly you can do at other things. And I think you're required, there's a lot being asked of you, and you need to continually evolve and self-reflect and think about what you do well and what you don't do well. And I really enjoy that process. And so generally, I really, really like it. I think my athletic background has made me appreciate working as a team more than some others. And I think there's still a million things I want to get better at.
Yeah, for sure. There are always things to improve. But before, you were in just a technical background, and now you're CEO. How is your day-to-day life?
Yeah, it is totally different. And for better and for worse, in some ways. I really enjoyed working as a data scientist. I really enjoyed I could spend a day without talking to anybody and just be investigating something and work a million, it's a giant problem solving exercise all day long. And I love that. I absolutely adore that. And I don't really get to do that as much anymore. It is, so much of the work now, even when it is data science work, is done from like a super high level. And it's done from designing an annotation set and saying like, hey, this is how we're going to define these rules, which is really fun too, but it still is just like a little bit higher level. And then talking to our engineers and data scientists about how model training is going and ways we can squeeze out more performance, and looking at the outputs and seeing where we go get wrong, and then trying to go back to the annotators and get more things done. And that's just the data science work of it. So like the data science work of my role is done at a higher level, which I really do enjoy. At some point, I think my previous experience has really helped me be pretty good at that. I do miss some of the in the weeds part, but then there's this whole other giant set of responsibilities of the CEO that have nothing to do with data science that I'm learning as I go. And I think I have some more interpersonal skills than some people with technical backgrounds have that makes me decent at them. I'm pretty good at the pitching and the fundraising side of it pretty just naturally. I think I'm a good explainer of things, and I can get excited, and I generally do decent at that. I'd say the marketing, fundraising is one part of being a CEO. Marketing is another part as an early stage company. We don't have a CMO yet. I have no marketing experience. I suck at it, but I have to do it. And that's kind of just like the part of a CEO as an early stage company is you have to wear a lot of different hats. So you have to be the chief fundraiser, you have to be the chief marketing officer, and I have to send out tweets and send out newsletters and post on Instagram and reach out to, it's more like sales, reach out to some institutions we may want to work with. And I don't think I'm particularly good at any of that stuff, but you kind of just have to learn on the fly, see what works, see what doesn't. And then there's a whole other bucket that is just like, anything else that needs to be done, whether it's like legal things or financial modeling or logistics and hiring, and you have to wear a lot of hats. And there's some things I'm good at, some things I'm not. And it's about, not having that imposter syndrome and being like, why am I doing this? I don't know what I'm doing. Like, you just have to do it. And you have to fight through that, and you have to see what works and see what doesn't, and just continue to get better, because you're going to do a million things.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think one of the hardest steps are hiring, because like you're hiring the people that are building your product. And sometimes it's super, super hard to find good enough people to work with you, because the best people, they are working for someone else. So this is, at least at Cantev, for me, well, I'm not a CTO or anything, but hiring is super hard and is a big problem that we have. We take like months and months to hire 1, 2, 3 good people, because we don't want to allow bad people to come to the company. And just another thing that is like, my CTO, he always says that when you are managing people, you don't have time anymore to code, to develop your technical skills. So you learn by procuration. You procurate a task to someone else in your team, and then the person going to do the task, and you're going to, okay.
That's what I meant by everything's done at a higher level, right? You're just like a step removed from it, and you're involved with it, and you know what's going on, and you can like guide it and kind of like envision what's in the code that's being written, but you're not really writing the code. You're doing everything from a high level. And there's some cool parts to that, but I do miss kind of being in the weeds sometimes. And then as far as hiring goes, yeah, I mean, it's one of the hardest things you can do, and it's one of the most important things you can do, and it's one of the reasons why it's hard is because of how important it is. And it's so critical, and messing up is such a big error, and doing it right is such a big value gained. And I think it's something we've done well. We got really lucky with our first hires, but I think it's because we had a high bar, we did take our time, and I think we need to continue to do that. But I think it also, there's a weird part to it that I think we were decent at, that is, it's similar to fundraising too, because like you said, so many of the best people are working great jobs already. And if you're going to have a shot to get some of them, you have to be able to pitch yourself, and you have, you know, it's a two-way interview process. And once they've passed your bar, you now have to pass their bar. And for people who are really, really great and may already have the job in the bag, you have to be really attractive. And we thought deeply about that in our first hires, and we're hiring right now and are thinking deeply about that right now. And like, yeah, you kind of have to put on your fundraising hat to some degree and really say why this is worth it. Now, inevitably, usually if you're an early stage company, the person you're hiring is probably taking a pay cut and getting equity in return. So you need to convince them that equity is going to be worth a lot someday. And I think we're really cognizant of that. And it's something I would encourage any entrepreneur to think deeply about during the interview process, that the whole time, even though you're trying to vet them to see if they cross the bar, know that you're being vetted too. And you want to, you know, make yourself seem attractive. Hopefully you are attractive, and hopefully you do. Yeah, you have a good thing going, but you want to make sure that is at the forefront of the interview process.
Yeah. One thing that attracts people to Contest, that the companies that I'm working, is my podcast.
Yeah, I believe it, man.
My podcast to convince people to come.
There's nothing weird about that at all, right? Like, it's, you get to really see who somebody is, and you get to learn what their opinions are on things and how they think about problems and how they think about the world. And it's a great, you know, it's a great piece of marketing in a lot of ways. And yeah, I totally get that.
Yeah. And for sure, people who say that listen to my podcast when they are in interviewing with me, they have at least a bit more of my attention.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's the same.
They did their homework.
I was about to say, it's like the A-plus version of the person who actually, like, you know, went through the whole website and learned about the company. Like, that's exactly that times two.
Yeah. Well, I think these are all the questions that I had for the episode. Do you have anything else to say before I ask the last question of the episode?
No, it's been great. Only thing, the product is free to sign up and use right now. You can find us at consensus.app. It's free to create an account. If you've ever wondered what the science, the research actually says about your questions, we've built Consensus for you. Come check it out, type in a search, and hopefully have a little fun with it.
Yeah, for sure. I will put the link on the description. And once I publish also on LinkedIn and on Instagram, I'm going to put the link so people can access on it. Okay, and awesome. The last question of the episode is, if you had something to say to people, no matter what would you say?
In the context of entrepreneurship or in the context of life?
Anything that you would like to people to listen. It's your moment.
All right, I'm going to say one about life and one about entrepreneurship. How about that?
Okay.
All right. About life, I think that the most important thing that anybody can do in their entire life that helps you selfishly and also just is a wonderful thing to put into the world that makes the world a better place is practice empathy. And you are never, ever, ever going to be wrong, or you're never, ever going to be led astray if you practice trying to feel the certain way that somebody's feeling and put yourself in their shoes and have empathy for people. And it is one of the only things that, no matter in what circumstance, you can almost never be wrong by having empathy for somebody, no matter what they've done and no matter what situation you're in. As far as entrepreneurship, I'd say the most important lesson I've learned is to beat down that voice in my head that is telling me that I shouldn't be doing something or that I don't belong there. And I think that one of the most important things for people to learn is that every person has that part, that voice in their head, that when they're in an important meeting or they're doing something scary, like, everybody has that imposter syndrome voice in their head. And I think too many people get scared off by having those thoughts. They say, oh, well, then this means I don't belong, so I can't do that. And I think it's really helpful that people understand this applies to other parts of life and anything people are trying to accomplish, that no matter how successful you are, no matter what you've done, people still have those thoughts of being a fraud in their head, and never let that stop you. And that voice is usually almost always lying to you.
Yeah, both of them are more than true. And I'm going to do something that I never did in the podcast. I'm going to share my one because no one ever asked me and I never said.
I love it.
Seeing that basketball behind you, do you know the Joel Embiid sentence that is trust the process?
Yeah.
My advice to people is enjoy the process. Because it doesn't matter if you fail in the end, you're going to enjoy it and you're going to have fun. And you're going to learn a lot of things that you can use in another project or another thing in your life. But always enjoy the process.
And keep going. Because the only way it fails is if you stop.
Yeah. Well, my podcast, I have like 60 episodes. And I don't know if I told you, but I do it in two languages. I do it in English and in Portuguese. So I have 60 episodes in Portuguese and in English. And I really don't know how I was able to do it because I was doing one episode per week for 1 year while working and sometimes while studying. So it was like really crazy, but I really enjoyed the process of doing it. And doesn't matter if it was too hard, but like it was super cool.
Yeah. And it doesn't matter if a million people listen to it or 10 people listen to it. If you enjoyed the process and learned something from it and made cool connections, then it was worthwhile.
How much I learned doing this
episode. Exactly.
I have read like more than 100 research papers to be able to do all these episodes.
I love it. That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, so thanks a lot for coming, Eric. It was really nice to have you in the episode. As I said, guys, I'm going to put the link of Consensus in the description of the episode and also on the post on LinkedIn and Instagram, so you can go check it. I think you enjoyed the episode. Just don't forget to go follow the podcast on Instagram and on LinkedIn. On Instagram is podcast Life with AI, and on LinkedIn it's just Life with AI. Until next episode, guys, goodbye.